This is the 11th hour for all of us to avoid a war that at best is going to be quite terrible for Iraqi people.
We have to keep, in a sense, a gun pointed to the head of the Iraqi regime, because that's the only way that they cooperate.
A priority will be, indeed, to secure the oil field so that that scorched earth policy does not exist.
Iraq holds the second largest proven stores of petroleum on the planet, making it a sweet plum for Western industrialized nations.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, January 2nd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraq said today it has cooperated with UN inspectors and that they have found no weapons of mass destruction in 5 weeks of searching, so their crucial report to the UN Security Council this month should favor Baghdad. The inspectors, however, said it's too soon to draw conclusions about whether Iraq has complied with UN demands, as it has to avoid war with the United States. The Bush administration cited 9 areas in which it said Iraq's declaration fails to provide a complete picture of actual weapons holdings. These included unaccounted for thousands of pounds of growth media for producing anthrax and chemical precursors for making mustard gas. Today, UN inspection teams visited 5 sites in the area around Baghdad, including a chemical plant, a state company that works on missile propellants, and an Air Force technical warehouse. As usual, they said nothing about their findings. Meanwhile, thousands of U.S. troops are being deployed into the region. Retired General Rear Admiral Steve Baker, senior fellow at the Center for Defense Information, says Central Commander General Tommy Franks has a checklist that's growing shorter by the minute in preparation for a potential invasion into Iraq.
That checklist is getting shorter and shorter, and what we're seeing now is more deployment orders. For example, more than 10,000 troops from the Army's 3rd Infantry Division have been told to be ready to leave immediately for the Persian Gulf, and the open part of that is it'll be sometime this month. The presence, I think, we're, if you count the personnel and the carrier battle groups in the amphibious readiness groups, are between 50,000 to 60,000, and I think we'll see incrementally that presence increase up to 100,000 troops.
Now, those are troops. What about the unmanned drones and the Predators that we know have been stationed in Kuwait near the border?
Yes, well, certainly those, the unmanned aerial vehicles, Predators and a Global Hawk or two, will be and are, I think, currently very active and will continue to be active in the surveillance and reconnaissance mode.
What kind of opposition are these 50 to 60,000 troops and Predators and unmanned drones, what kind of opposition are they going to face? What does the Iraqi army look like at this point?
Well, as all the reports that I have seen, and I certainly concur with the fact that they're probably about one-third the strength and one-third the capabilities that they had back in the Iraqis had back in Desert Storm time frame. And you add on to that the fact that through our sanctions, the ability to upgrade and maintain a lot of the military equipment in Iraq has been seriously eroded. They're not in good shape at all, and they're lower than that would probably be the morale of the Republican Guard and the Iraqi army as well. So there's quite a few factors that really do play in the a coalition led by the United States' favor. Certainly, if they're one-third the capabilities, we, I would say, are about 10 times the capability of lethality and sophistication than we were back in Desert Storm days. Mm. If the special Republican Guard that are concentrated in Baghdad would be the most ready, if you will, and the most prepared with the best equipment, and they could put up a fight. But again, with the lethality that the United States has now with precision-guided munitions, it is going to be a very, I think, one-sided conflict if that conflict comes about.
Now, we read reports a few days ago that the U.S. will secure Iraqi oil fields if it invades to protect Iraq from the earlier announced scorched earth strategy that Saddam Hussein's army would likely employ if he started to lose power. As a retired rear admiral in the military, what's your analysis?
Well, I think that we're certainly trying to cover all bases in contingencies, and certainly on the priority list of any military campaign against Iraq is we have to honor the potential or pay attention to the potential that as Saddam did in Kuwait when he exited Kuwait back in Desert Storm 1991 time frame, he left with a scorched earth policy where he lit off all the Kuwaiti oil fields, and the potential for him, if he knows that he's going down and it's in the last effort to bring down and do as much harm and destruction as he can to torch off his own oil fields, certainly we have to honor the potential of that, if you get my gist. And for that reason, a priority will be indeed to secure the oil field so that scorched earth policy does not exist. And I think it is in concert with the concern humanitarian-wise of not to have the entire country of Iraq into an Armageddon where the infrastructure is destroyed. So there's going to be some attention paid to that as well.
There's been a lot of concern, obviously, that if backed into a corner, Saddam Hussein might also unleash chemical or biological weapons. And in a report in today's Washington Post, soldiers that are American troops that are based there in Kuwait are concerned by being so close to the perimeter. What's your analysis of that?
Well, certainly, that is another threat that we have to honor and pay attention to. Certainly the leadership in the Ba'ath Party, and specifically Saddam Hussein himself, has said that if the coalition forces attack his country, he will bring about horrendous death and destruction to all people that are part of that, including the neighboring countries. And if you take another step on that, what he just said, what Saddam means is that he'll use his weapons of mass destruction, the ones that currently he says he does not have, against anyone that invades his country. So just as probably even a higher priority of securing the oil fields would be looking for any type of mobile or launch vehicles in the form of Scuds and to control the areas very, very rapidly of where those Scud missiles could be launched, sending missiles of or weapons of mass destruction into either Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, or Israel.
Saudi Arabia announced earlier this week, Admiral Baker, that it will now allow the U.S. military to use its bases to launch possible attacks against Iraq. Who are the other U.S. allies in the region, and how does their support of the U.S. square with the sentiments of their people?
Well, I think that the entire region, if we did have an invasion of Iraq with a coalition force, Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, and the UAE, and certainly Qatar, as well as Diego Garcia and Saudi Arabia, all would have support for our bases. The latest that has been put out officially, it's actually unofficial, Pentagon officials are saying they have private assurances from the Saudis that U.S. aircraft refuelers and cargo and surveillance planes could operate from the kingdom in the event of war with Iraq. And I think those coordination efforts will continue. There is unrest in such areas as certainly Saudi Arabia, certainly as in Bahrain, for example, where some very significant riots and anti-war demonstrations have occurred recently in Bahrain. So the sensitivity we're well aware of, but I think overall the support in all the countries will be there, and we do need it.
Is this a war, Admiral Baker, that you feel the U.S. needs to be fighting?
I cannot justify right now as we speak, the need for an invasion, and I don't think that the administration can either. There's really not a rationalization or a justification, and what I mean by that is a smoking gun that points clearly and credibly for the rest of the world, domestically and internationally, to understand why an invasion is necessary. And I the question here in Washington, D.C., is it going to be February or March? And I don't think we're driven by the calendar. I do believe the administration, when they say they'd like to avert a war, if at all possible. And so
you believe the administration when they say that?
I do believe it, because I think we're going to play the United Nations card with the inspectors. And the justification right now, as I speak, is not there, or the rationalization for an invasion of Iraq. And that, as well, to have a coalition, you have to have that justification to have the international and domestic support that is necessary. We have to have more than we currently have put out to the world.
Retired Rear Admiral Stephen Baker, senior fellow at the Center for Defense Information. The government-controlled Iraqi press also reproached the Security Council for tightening controls on imports to the country, saying council members were following the dictates of Washington, furthering the, quote, mad U.S. attempts to wage aggression on Iraq, unquote. General Hossam Mohammed Amin, Iraq's chief liaison to the U.N. inspectors, said the inspections so far, visits to 237 sites in 5 weeks, gave credence to Baghdad's assertion that it has no more banned weapons. Amin said the inspections had been intrusive and included surprise visits. Speaking before the UN Security Council earlier this week, Syrian ambassador said that Syria abstained because there wasn't adequate time to review the proposed resolution to tighten restrictions on the food for oil program.
The delegation of the Syrian Arab Republic abstained from voting on resolution 1454, just adopted by the Council. And in this regard, we would like to clarify the following points. First, Syria, which voted in favor of resolution 1447 that called for the extension of the oil for food program, did take into account the need to alleviate the suffering of the Iraqi people and the need to meet its needs, especially the basic humanitarian needs. Syria feels that Iraq's cooperation with the United Nations weapon inspectors and its constructive approach in dealing with Resolution 1441 should inevitably lead to the lifting of sanctions imposed against Iraq, and not to complicating the sanctions regime by adding further restrictions under the pretext of the dual use of certain goods. Two, the speed which negotiations took place and that led to the putting the draft resolution to the vote did not allow Syria enough time in order to examine in depth the list of goods, taking into our consideration the complex technical nature of these goods, the examination of which would require high technical expertise and adequate time. And therefore, Syria was not able to vote in favor of the resolution because it could not fully examine its implications in order to ensure that this resolution would not have an adverse impact on the interests of the Iraqi population. I thank you, Mr. President.
Syrian Ambassador Mikhail Webby. Iraqi Deputy Ambassador Mohammed Salman addressed the press after the council meeting.
The Security Council adopted the new measures and restrictions that will hinder and create obstacles in the implementation of the oil for food program under the pretext of dual use. We have made it quite clear that this program has not been able to respond to the needs of the Iraqi people, and nothing but the lifting of the sanctions will end the suffering of the Iraqi people. The Security Council should have solved the question of the pricing mechanism of the oil purchase that has caused the severe shortage in the oil for food program. Instead of that, due to the political agenda of the United States that has nothing to do with the purpose of this program, we see that the Council is adopting new restrictions. We regret the fact that the Security Council is working in such a selective and double standard manner. Again, we confirm that the Security Council should lift the sanctions after that Iraq has implemented all its obligations according to resolutions. Thank you.
Has any indication of what impact do you think that this vote is likely going to have on the situation on the ground in Iraq? Issues like atropine and access to Cipro and that sort of thing.
It prevents everything. It prevents all facilities for communications and put restrictions on the need of Iraq to medicine and other medical equipments.
Thank you. About the way the U.S. is handling the tensions.
Thank you.
Ambassador, there is a claim that this has actually eased the oil for food program in the sense that this will make the procedures faster, quicker, more streamlined. Do you accept that
this is the claim of the U.S.? This is the claim. It hinders the humanitarian supplies rather than facilitating this issue.
Iraqi Deputy Ambassador Mohammed Salman. While the U.S. prepares for war in Iraq, dozens of Westerners demonstrated in front of the U.N. building New Year's Eve in Baghdad. Michael Birmingham is a member of the Voices in the Wilderness peace team. We spoke with him earlier today.
There was about 35 mainly U.S. citizens and some people from other countries like Canada, Ireland, New Zealand, who came together on the morning of New Year's Day as the weapons inspectors were about to leave for what's their routine daily inspections, and also on the night of New Year's Eve. And they basically sang some songs and made a number of statements calling on the U.S. government to not rush ahead with these war plans that seem to be underway at present.
Mm-hmm.
And to take into account the vulnerability of the Iraqi people at the moment. You know, a lot of people died as a result of the Gulf War in 1991, and truthfully, the Iraqi population are incredibly more vulnerable now and less able to withstand deprivation and war than they were in 1991. Those of us who attended that protest outside the UN were hoping that something more positive might be possible at this stage than to cut off and to launch bombs on people who really deserve a lot better after 12 years of sanctions and war that has brought nothing but hardship, nothing in the way of human rights, and truthfully nothing in the way of a safer world for any of us.
Is there any evidence of bombing or U.S. drones or planes overhead as you walk down the streets of Baghdad these days? What is your sense of the military buildup there?
Going around Baghdad, you see virtually no evidence of military buildup. Actually, as you do in a lot of Middle Eastern cities, you see soldiers with police cars at junctions here and there. But it's quite underwhelming, if anything. You know, the soldiers are low-key and chatting to each other. They say hello to passers-by. There's very few of them. There's almost no sense that you can see walking around of people preparing for war. But over the last number of weeks, I've been here 2 months, talking to Baghdadis, they're increasingly asking, do we as Westerners believe that there's going to be war? Some of them are hearing reports coming in from the radio stations that are broadcast into Iraq from outside that war is imminent, and they're getting scared. Some people have said that they're stockpiling food. You know, Iraqis live on a very basic ration, the vast majority of the population, and some of them are trying to stockpile what they can out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's all behind the scenes, and it's very low key, because I think people don't really have the resources to do much more than that at the moment. They just have to wait and hope. There's very little preparation open to ordinary people, and the government preparations, whatever they are not visible to the eye.
Mm. Iraq invited Hans Blix, the chief of the UN weapons inspectors, to come to the country in the next few weeks. What does the average Baghdadian see with regard to these weapons inspections? Do they see teams moving about, or how does that manifest?
No, you see very little of it. I have actually seen them once going around and in what looked like a fairly high-speed convoy. I'm kind of confident enough to assume it was weapons inspectors, and I have seen them from being outside the UN to know what they look like. But you really don't see them. I guess they go and come from the UN complex on the outskirts of Baghdad, and they go straight to the weapons site. They're staying in a hotel here, which is mainly also used by journalists. So ordinary Baghdadis wouldn't see a lot of the weapons inspectors.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the Baghdad or the Iraqi media reporting about this impending war?
They've been broadcasting some statements from the government saying that if the American troops come here, they'll be fought steadfastly. They won't find it as easy as they think, that people will fight them. They've also been broadcasting along that more hopeful kind of messages than what you might read from the Western media. But like I say, you know, a lot of Iraqis have access to both the government stations and television stations, and also they get messages in through alternative radio stations. And,
mm-hmm. Would you say that there's anxiety building in Baghdad among the people?
Yeah, my sense is that there certainly is anxiety beginning to grow. It's not a subject that's particularly easy to speak about here. People don't like to talk about politics at all if they can avoid it. I mean, what you notice more than anything is that people asking you that question of whether there's going to be war, and oftentimes people ask you why. Why is the American government doing this? But, you know, like I say, you have to take that within the context that, for the most part, ordinary people just prefer to get on with their lives and not to discuss this much.
Where does Ireland stand in terms of this war?
Ireland has been a member of the Security Council and has raised its concern, the government has raised its concern about the humanitarian situation of the Iraqi people after 12 years of sanctions. They voted in favour of the recent resolution 1441. It was a unanimous vote at the Security Council, and I think most people feel that the Irish government would have been under considerable pressure from the US to not oppose that resolution, and it would have been incredibly difficult for us with the amount of American foreign investment in Ireland to have done any different. The vast majority of Irish people are opposed to a war. The most recent poll done by our major national newspaper showed that 58% of Irish people were against a war on Iraq, even if there was UN support for that war. And up to 70%, I think 68% of people were against the war, which didn't have UN support. So it's overwhelmingly the Irish people are against war, but the Irish government's line is not so clear.
Mm. Right. Any final thoughts on your part?
I just hope that maybe people will appreciate that this really is the 11th hour for all of us who are concerned that to avert what, you know, a war that at best is going to be quite terrible for Iraqi people. You know, at the moment UNICEF has said there's 1 million Iraqi children who are chronically malnourished, and that's a vastly improved situation to what it has been over the last 12 years, but there's still an incredible poverty amongst these people. They've sold everything that was valuable to them, most people have, and they're living on basic rations. This is one of the most efficient food distribution systems in the world, according to the World Food Programme. If war cuts off that food program. People have nothing to live on. And, you know, a lot of people could die, you know, in the best case scenario for this war where there's not massive bombing and massive casualties, but simply a dislocation of the food distribution system. I think what good can come out of that is very hard to see. And those of us who want to see a more just world, you know, rather than one based on violence, you know, and the rule of the powerful, we need to act now because it's going to be too late soon. And I hope people can bear that in mind.
Michael Birmingham of Voices in the Wilderness giving us the view from Baghdad. South Korea rejected a proposal from the communist North to work together against the United States and told Pyongyang today to stop saber rattling. South Korea Unification Minister Jong Se-hung also said the North's leadership should not attempt to test the limit of the patience of the international community. Young, whose ministry handles inter-Korean affairs, said his government will use upcoming inter-Korean cabinet-level talks to urge North Korea to stop efforts to restart its nuclear facilities. The meetings, which are the highest channels of dialogue between the two sides, will provide the first opportunity for South Korea to directly raise the nuclear issue with the North. Ralph and Maya Schoen of Pacifica Station WBAI have been following the North Korean crisis and offer this commentary.
As the United States heads for a confrontation, or should I say, provokes a confrontation with North Korea, it is instructive to remember the nuclear posture review that was exposed last January, in which the Bush administration directed the military to prepare contingency plans to use nuclear weapons against at least 7 countries, one of them being North Korea, and to build smaller nuclear weapons for use in battlefield situations.
Actually, Maya, the New York Times on the 29th of December described a comprehensive plan that the Bush administration has drawn up to intensify financial and political pressure on North Korea aimed at precipitating an economic and political collapse, escalating the standoff over North Korea's nuclear program. And what's instructive about the article is that it exposes that Washington's demand for the dismantling of nuclear facilities, which are primarily to provide electric power in a very deprived country, were equipped with a promise that the Clinton people had given the North Koreans that they would provide alternative energy facilities for electric power, which they did not do. And what's interesting, too, about this piece is that it cites General Luck, the U.S. commander in Korea, who estimated on the basis of the experience in Vietnam and the Persian Gulf, and I'm quoting, that due to the colossal lethality, as he says, of the weapons that they were going to use in Korea, as many as 1 million people would be killed in the resumption of full-scale war.
The South Koreans exposed on December 27th that the United States would plan to deploy almost 700,000 troops to augment the 37,000 American troops that have been occupying Korea since the 1950s. This was revealed by the South Korean Defense Ministry.
And General Luck estimated that 100,000 Americans can be expected to die in this adventure, and it will cost over $100 billion to the United States and $1 trillion to the countries involved and their immediate neighbors, unquote. We are talking about a major disaster, not only now in suffering Iraq, but in Korea and in South Asia as well. This ruling class is ruthless indeed, and we must mobilize in this new year, all of us, to stop this march towards permanent war.
This is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.